Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. I'll begin today with the conclusion of Hard Rain, The Battle Over Weather Modification by Wyatt Williams. The article covers the technology that has been used, such as drones, in trying to induce rain, and focuses on some of the young entrepreneurs involved. The article resumes now. Not long after I went to Pendleton, I drove to the northeast corner of the Great Salt Lake, to the remote edge where Robert Smithson built the Spiral Jetty in 1970. That week, I'd been working remotely from Utah, clocking in at 3 a.m. to help cover a winter storm that had stretched across the country from Texas to Maine. Footage was coming in from Mississippi, where branches of winter trees and power lines were collapsing under thick casings of ice. The National Weather Service was reporting 27 inches of snow in Kittery, Maine, and 23 inches at Boston Logan International Airport. 26 states saw more than 6 inches of snow that week, but almost all of them were in the eastern half of the country, far from the snow drought plaguing the West. The water simply wouldn't fall where it was needed. When I clocked out 8 hours later, I could look out the window of my condo and see the slopes of Deer Valley packed with skiers, white snow-spotted with the fluorescent colors of Gore-Tex jackets. There wouldn't even be enough snow to ski on were it not for the fact that ski resorts have built their own weather modification systems fueled by the region's dwindling water supply. Snow machines puff out clouds of powder onto the slopes at night. Directly next to the winding slopes, the ground was bare and brown. Driving north along the interstate, the density of suburban homes slowly dissolved into grazing land. Herds of black Angus dotted in the dry grass, hayfields with bales stacked as high as barns. I passed a solar farm, panels facing the noonday sun, and when the pavement ended, I switched the Jeep into four-wheel drive. I'd read essays by writers making their pilgrimage down this road to see Smithson's masterpiece, and they warned of thick mud, ice, snow that could cripple a smaller vehicle. The road was bone dry, dusty. Prior to making the Spiral Jetty, Smithson had seen aerial photographs of earthworks in Peru, long, artful striations across the mountains, unmistakably unnatural, that long outlived the people and societies who built them. Were they meant to be seen by God? Smithson hired trucks to carry loads of basalt rocks to the edge of the lake, where they were dumped one at a time until they completed a path 500 yards long. He died in a plane crash only 3 years later, looking down at the earth to scout out a location for another work that could be seen from above. Smithson anticipated that the lake would modify his creation, wearing down the basalt, weathering his shape into the earth. In the 80s, an unprecedented period of precipitation for the region raised the level of the lake, submerging the jetty and hiding it for years. Eventually, that trend reversed and the jetty reemerged. It had changed somewhat differently than Smithson had imagined. As the current drought took hold, the shore of the lake has receded, abandoning the jetty entirely. On the afternoon I arrived, the edge of the Salt Lake was a white line somewhere off in the distance, almost a mirage. It appeared to belong to a desert. A few steer browsed a high ridge, looking for grass among the brittle sagebrush. Two jet fighters roared across the sky to Hill Air Force Base. I walked slowly along the curve of the basalt until I reached the spiral center. Smithson's work is quite obviously about time, the long drive out, the slow process of balancing as you step from one rock to the next. It elongates the moment, leaving you with plenty of space to consider the things we are doing to the earth. Of all of the lines we have made, I don't think Smithson's will be of much note. With the spiral divorced from the water that once made it grand and colorful, the spiral jetty now looks insignificant, as if a single turn of the wind might cover it with sand. There were thin clouds in the blue sky that day. Somewhere off in the distance, there were drones in a warehouse waiting for the right conditions. Somewhere up in the atmosphere, water was floating along. We might think of cloud seeding as a kind of accelerator. Were we to ever master it, it would hasten the changes of weather that we wait or pray for. Droughts would still come, but we could end them sooner. We could tell the rain to fall in the places where we need it. When the land around you is dry, it's easy to believe it will go on that way forever. Stories about doom are easy to write. They seem inevitable. That's a problem of storytelling, though, not of the world. The real world is much weirder than the narratives we try to fit it into. The endings and beginnings we shape are only for ourselves. They shave off the strange chaos to make it a little more understandable, to give it a little meaning. We should know by now that the conclusions we are headed toward haven't been written yet, that they require a new kind of imagination. They ask us to see something in the sky we don't yet know how to describe. 2 days later, it began to snow. Wyatt Williams is the author of Springer Mountain, Meditations on Killing and Eating. Next, I'll be reading a letter from Washington titled The Data Center Divide, Why Politicians Are Squandering the Anti-AI Backlash by Andrew Cockburn. The governing board of Saline Township, a farming community of some 2,200 residents in Washtenaw County, Michigan, meets on the second Wednesday of every month in a white clapboard hall down a muddy, unpaved road. On a rainy evening this March, the hall was packed with members of the public listening intently for mention of the single issue that has dominated discussion in Saline since last year, the approximately $16 billion, 1.4 gigawatt data center being developed there by Related Digital, an offshoot of the powerful New York real estate firm Related, which is owned by the billionaire Stephen Ross. The campus, built on behalf of the software giant Oracle and OpenAI, is part of a massive AI infrastructure project known as Stargate, which aims to bring 4.5 gigawatts of additional data center capacity to the United States. Slated to occupy 250 acres of local farmland and to draw enough electricity from the grid to power Detroit, it is the largest economic scheme ever attempted in the state of Michigan. At first, Saline's five-person nonpartisan governing board resisted the development. Last September, after outcry from locals, members voted 4-1 to deny Related Digital the rezoning permissions required for the data center's construction. But lawyers for Related Digital and property owners of the proposed site promptly sued Saline, claiming that the company had been the victim of exclusionary zoning that prevented the free use of private land. The possibility of an expensive legal fight with a giant corporation had the intended effect. After consulting with its attorneys, the board conceded, accepting a settlement offer that would allow the data center to proceed with only minimal concessions from the firm. To Robbie Dubay, a Minneapolis-based attorney specializing in government disputes, the lawsuit was a familiar corporate maneuver. "I've seen this in my cases all across the country," he told me. "It is a shockingly similar playbook every single time. The only difference was how quickly the board folded." In Dubay's view, the case was meritless to begin with, but Saline's board had been terrified by threats along the lines of, "I'm going to come here and obliterate you. You will be bankrupted. I have infinite money." The board, adopting a milder attitude than its counterpart across Lake Michigan in Port Washington, Wisconsin, where city officials had a peaceful data center opponent violently arrested at a public meeting, justified its surrender by claiming that, while board members still opposed the project, their hands were tied. At first, this recent turmoil was barely apparent at the March meeting. as township officials quietly deliberated on such issues as the fire department budget and conservation easements. The edifice under construction, just a few minutes' drive away, was invoked in diffident terms, as when board members discussed the small fines they had negotiated with Related Digital for construction trucks that violated local ordinances and debated whether a special post office box would be required to receive them. But when Saline residents finally had their chance to speak, a volley of pointed questions followed. They asked about the emissions from the fossil fuels that would be used to generate power for the data center, the bright lights from the construction site shining into children's bedrooms late at night and before dawn, and local roads that had been rendered dangerous by constant construction-related traffic. None of these impassioned complaints appeared to engender much sympathy from the board, or indeed from the three Related Digital executives who were sitting against the wall observing the proceedings. The woman who'd asked about the construction lights was Catherine Haushalter, a Marine Corps veteran who served in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. She and her husband own a farm where she homeschools four of their five children less than 300 yards from the data center's construction site. Haushalter is familiar to both the Saline Governing Board and Related Digital. Late last year, she filed a motion to defend the board's original rejection of the rezoning proposal, alleging that the settlement had violated the Open Meetings Act. A judge summarily denied her request in February, but Haushalter wasn't ready to give up. Although her legal bills were already in the tens of thousands, she was planning to fight on. "I always thought, thank God I live in a country where I have a voice and the little guys matter," Haushalter told me. "And then this happens." The Stargate Project, endorsed and promoted at every level of authority, from the White House to the governor of Michigan to the local worthies of Saline, had tested her faith in democracy. "I expect the federal government not to care about the little guys, but your local government, your neighbors, my neighbors are on that board," she said. "It's shocking. Nobody's listening to us. The people who we voted in aren't listening to us. The regulatory agencies aren't protecting us. And now we feel like the law is failing us." As ever larger data centers proliferate across the country, Saline is one battleground among many in the fight to halt their construction. There are several others in this corner of Michigan alone. Lowell Township, 100 miles to the northwest, drove off a project at the beginning of the year. The night before the board meeting I attended in Saline, officials in York, the next township over, voted in favor of a six-month moratorium on all data center proposals. Earlier that week, I had dropped in on a meeting in the township of Lyon, where irate locals confronted a commission that had conditionally greenlit a six-building, 172-acre data center project. They approved it in one meeting. A Dunkin' Donuts had to go through multiple public hearings, but this $4 billion data center required no public hearing, said Mikhaila Charnik, one of the leaders of a local opposition group. We met in the parking lot outside the township hall, where she was distributing protest signs to other attendees. It was done in a single conversation and kept very much under wraps. "I found out about it on Facebook, like everyone else," Charnik told me. According to the research project Data Center Watch, there are now 142 groups like Charnik's operating across 24 states. Some have been highly effective. A review of public records by the climate news outlet Heatmap found that at least 25 data center projects were canceled in 2025 due to local pushback, and that 99 more were being contested as of January. This resistance is significant in its own right, but it is also the most visible manifestation of growing skepticism toward the promises of AI. Recent surveys by the Pew Research Center have found that half of Americans are more concerned than excited about the increased use of AI in daily life. A similar proportion believe that it will worsen our ability to think creatively and form meaningful relationships. And Americans are more likely to believe that AI will have a negative effect on education and the economy than a positive one. Politicians and AI evangelists have pitched the rapid construction of new data centers as a prerequisite to an AI revolution that will unleash unprecedented technological advances, such as the discovery of solutions to climate change or a cure for cancer. For local communities, however, this revolution means crippling electricity bills, a threatened water supply, and ceaseless noise and pollution from data centers, diesel-powered backup generators. These fears have driven thousands of citizens to pack town halls deep into the night to voice their opposition. Scenes that recall the origins of the Tea Party movement in the early 2010s. But whereas the Tea Party was fostered by support from moneyed interests, notably the right-wing Koch machine, and quickly adopted by segments of the Republican Party, data center resistance has not received any real institutional backing, nor is it a strictly partisan movement. The fight over AI data centers is not about right versus left. It's not about Democrats and Republicans. It's not about suburban versus rural. It's really about top versus bottom, said Saul Levin, a Washington-based activist who supervises a Signal chat connecting data center opposition groups around the country. The most elite people, billionaires, governors, tech oligarchs, are in favor. But if you talk to working-class Republican Christians in Texas, if you talk to anarchists in Tennessee, if you talk to apolitical moms and IT workers in the state of Oregon, or farmers, you hear pretty similar things. We don't want some massive building that's going to make noise and pollute our water and air and raise costs for us with no tangible benefits. Charnak's description of her own group echoes Levin's point. We're completely bipartisan, she told me, hugely so. The output from the community, on top of being bipartisan, is that nothing like this has ever happened to them in their lives. A lot of people feel disenfranchised. Basically, we don't trust anybody. People have been way out ahead of the politicians. Faiz Shakir, the founder of the media nonprofit More Perfect Union and Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign manager, told me they were mobilizing fights against data centers long before many politicians noticed. And they were winning fights in places like Tucson, St. Charles, and Indianapolis. Shakir pointed out that only a handful of national figures on either side of the aisle have forcefully criticized AI, singling out Republicans like the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and the former Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene as notable outliers in their party. There are hardly more examples on the Democrat side, where Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's call for a temporary pause on all data center construction has attracted only marginal support. As for the Democratic leadership, their preferences are readily apparent. Last December, the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, announced the formation of a House Democratic Commission on AI and the innovation economy that was stacked with members deemed reliably friendly to the AI industry. Jeffries installed as co-chair the North Carolina Representative Valerie Fouché, who was then locked in a tight primary race with an avowedly anti-AI challenger, Nita Allam, in a district facing a proposed data center. Fouché's appointment had the desired effect of directing a gusher of AI cash into her campaign, enabling her to edge out her progressive opponent by 1 percentage point. The cause for Republicans' general unwillingness to embrace anti-AI politics is obvious. Donald Trump himself is closely aligned with the tech oligarchs who run the industry. But for Democrats, the aversion may seem more puzzling. After all, local Democratic candidates running in Virginia and Georgia on anti-data center platforms swept to victory last year, and a March poll by Quinnipiac University found that a majority of American adults oppose the building of a data center in their community. Why then has the party failed to capitalize on the obvious political opportunity to get behind this opposition? The political economy of Michigan provides an instructive explanation. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, often touted as a viable Democratic presidential nominee, has always offered a helping hand to major corporations, even when the benefits to her constituents are dubious. During her time in the Michigan State Legislature from 2001 to 2015, she voted in favor of $4.5 billion in business subsidies, siding with corporate interests more frequently than the vast majority of her colleagues. According to the nonprofit newsroom Bridge Michigan, since taking office as governor in 2019, Whitmer has spent nearly $1 billion of taxpayer money on corporate incentives that have delivered only a fifth of the jobs they promised to create. Notably, in 2023, she committed some $175 million to a Chinese-owned electrical vehicle battery plant that generated significant local opposition and ultimately amounted to nothing. Michigan's burgeoning data center industry has given Whitmer more opportunities to offer financial inducements to some of the richest companies in the world. In 2024, she backed legislation to grant total exemptions on sales and use taxes for large-scale data centers, arguing that they would deliver jobs and economic development to the state. Initially blocked by recalcitrant Democratic members of the House, the legislation was reintroduced during a lame duck session following the 2024 election. At the urging of the outgoing Democratic House Speaker Joe Tate, it passed with Republican votes and went into effect in April 2025. Companies such as Oracle and OpenAI demanded more than just tax breaks to operate data centers in Michigan. However, they wanted a guaranteed power supply from the state's dominant utility, DTE Energy. DTE was only too happy to comply. Sales of electricity have long been flat, but the proliferation of data centers promises a massive increase in demand and, in turn, higher profits, making utility companies eager allies of the AI industry. Last October, DTE requested state approval on two contracts to provide 1.4 gigawatts of power to the Saline Data Center. Significant portions of the contracts were redacted, but the three Whitmer-appointed regulators on Michigan's Public Service Commission waved them through anyway, agreeing to DTE's request that the contracts be accepted without public debate. Whitmer personally signaled her support, stating via press release that Michigan has always been a leader in building the next big thing and extolling the thousands of construction and good-paying jobs that the Saline Data Center would allegedly generate while protecting ratepayers from price hikes. Among the many Michiganders aghast at this lubrication of a multi-billion-dollar corporate initiative cloaked in secrecy was one official with the power to do something about it. Dana Nessel, Michigan's Attorney General since 2019, has long been a thorn in the side of DTE, complaining vehemently to the public about the utility's repeated demands for rate increases. She has no higher opinion of the Public Service Commission, which she derided when we met at her Lansing office as more than a shill for the utility companies than a protector of consumers in this state. Nessel discussed political realities with a candor rare among public officials. These companies, particularly DTE and Consumers Energy, which are the top two energy providers in our state of both gas and electric, are also, by happenstance, two of the biggest political contributors, and they contribute to everybody. That means almost every single state legislator takes money from them, she told me. The governor, the secretary of state for some reason. I do believe that the Public Service Commission has been bought and paid for by DTE and by other utilities. Her specific complaint about the saline deal was that the heavily redacted contracts made it impossible for her or the public to know how the utility planned to supply the power required to run the Stargate campus day and night, and yet somehow still be able to provide enough electricity to the rest of the DTE customers without raising our rates. She was therefore demanding that the contracts be reconsidered in a contested hearing in which their terms could be evaluated by experts on all sides. As Nessel explained, public opinion in Michigan is largely uniform on the subject of data centers. On most of the big issues facing the state, you really have a red or blue side, she said. Not so when it comes to data centers. We're seeing a lot of crossover. And I've seen polls where as high as 89% of our state residents do not want to see data centers come in the way that they are being permitted to right now. But some of Michigan's highest profile candidates in the forthcoming midterm elections are throwing their weight behind these projects anyway. The current Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, a frontrunner in the race for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, has expressed enthusiasm for the Saline Data Center, which, according to her spokesman, will create thousands of jobs in southeast Michigan. Her support, garnished with pious caveats about the need to prevent the center from boosting residents' already sky-high electricity bills or curbing access to clean water, became easier for Michiganders to understand when it came to light that her husband, Ryan Friedrichs, is a vice president at Related Digital and had been directly involved in the project. Ross, Related's billionaire owner, contributed more than $8,000 to Benson's campaign. As of this March, Friedrichs was apparently still taking a close interest. Sharp-eyed attendees at the town meeting I attended said that Gregory Gouchet, one of the senior Related Digital executives monitoring the proceedings, had been busily texting a Ryan F. throughout the evening. They must still be nervous about us, said Catherine Haushalter, who spotted the messages. Clearly, money has played a decisive role in the politics of AI, both on the federal level, where Trump's attempts to block states from regulating any aspect of AI were surely influenced by the millions of dollars he's received from luminaries, such as the OpenAI co-founder Greg Brockman, and in states like Michigan. But it is no less influential in local politics, all the way down to individual counties. Consider Virginia's Prince William County, on the outskirts of Washington, the proposed site of a digital gateway consisting of 37 data centers that, if completed, would be the largest data center complex in the world. Local resistance to the project has been fierce since the beginning, but a Democratic majority on the county's governing board of supervisors nonetheless voted to rezone the required agricultural land for development in December 2023. As in Michigan, Virginia's principal utility, Dominion Energy, wields immense power thanks to its bottomless purse. Since 2010, the company has contributed more than $1 million to Luke Turian, the delegate representing Prince William County in the state assembly. During the 2023 election cycle, when discussions regarding the digital gateway were underway, Turian raised some $800,000 from Dominion and other entities with a stake in getting the gateway built, including the Data Center Coalition, Amazon, landowners near the proposed site, and not least, the International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, which has become an important part of the data center lobby. When he wound up running unopposed, he was free to distribute his war chest to other campaigns. In October 2023, 2 months before board members were due to cast their crucial rezoning votes, Turian disbursed some $42,500 to the coffers of four Democrats running for re-election to the county's Board of Supervisors, all of whom went on to support the digital gateway. The fight then moved to the courts, where last August, a judge struck down the rezoning decision on the grounds that the vote had been taken without adequate public notice. But the Board of Supervisors didn't relent. To date, Prince William County has spent $1.6 million of taxpayers' money in legal fees defending the project, which was finally killed by the Virginia Court of Appeals in April. You are listening to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. The case of Virginia, which hosts more than a quarter of all the hyperscale data centers in the world, shows just how difficult it can be to dislodge the influence of industry money. For years, developers and technology companies have enjoyed a hearty welcome from state authorities eager for promised jobs and economic gain. In 2008, when the state's Democratic governor, Tim Kaine, approved a sales tax exemption for data centers over a certain scale, companies flocked to the state to take advantage. As thousands of acres of farmland disappeared under concrete colossi and residential neighborhoods began to reverberate with the ubiquitous hum of machines over the next several years, the state government and legislature rejoiced in the torrent of investment, echoing calls to win the AI race with China, even as Virginians' power bills edged remorselessly upward, climbing by some 30% since 2021 alone. Republicans, data center enthusiasts, controlled the state government from 2022 to early this year, with Glenn Youngkin as governor. During that time, efforts to control the spread of data centers went nowhere in the assembly. Bills deemed unfriendly to the industry often failed to advance out of committee. If they passed, they were inevitably vetoed by Youngkin. There were probably 40-plus bills that touched on regulating data centers. Dan Holmes, a lobbyist who tracks data center legislation in Richmond, recalled of each of the last two legislative sessions, when Republicans still ruled. Nothing passed. The 2025 state elections, in which Democrats gained control of the House and the governor's mansion, seemed to herald change, with the victory of several critics of data center development. Abigail Spanberger, the newly elected governor, promised to be less amenable to corporate demands than her predecessor, even as she still seemed overly impressed by national security arguments about the threat of Chinese competition in AI. The most serious assault on the industry thus far came in February, when Senator L. Louise Lucas, a former shipyard worker and the chair of the Virginia State Finance and Appropriations Committee, advanced a proposal to repeal the data center's cherished sales tax exemption, which now costs the state an estimated $1.9 billion a year, money she said was needed for social services, transport, and education. Her proposal easily passed the Senate, but it went nowhere in the House, where Democrats' efforts at reform have hit an obstacle in the figure of the House Speaker, Don Scott, the recipient of more than $3 million in campaign donations from Dominion. The Speaker of the House, and to some degree the governor, are signaling they're not willing to take away the toys from the data center industry, Holmes said. Even so, the fact that a few unwelcome bills have come close to succeeding has the industry nervous, he suggested. They've never been so fearful, Holmes said. He worries that the data center companies could unleash even more financial firepower as a result, potentially dwarfing Dominion's already considerable contributions. And if that happens, he said, then good luck reforming the industry. If Virginia Democrats are beginning to style themselves as data center opponents, in Michigan, the politics of data center resistance remain up for grabs. In the governor's race, I had to look to the Republican lineup to find a full-throated critic. Tom Leonard, the former Speaker of the House in the state legislature, has built his campaign around the issue since the day he went on local TV and said that he was a hard no on data centers in the state, based on their failure to deliver promised jobs and the likelihood that they would drive up utility bills. His comments drew an enthusiastic response. The next day, I woke up and I just had dozens of messages on Facebook and in my email, people saying, "Hey, you're the only candidate for governor willing to speak up. Thank you," Leonard told me. "I've been doing this for several months, and I can tell you there is a huge grassroots movement that a lot of politicians are underestimating right now. They don't understand how important this is going to be to the electorate as we head into November." Anthony Hudson, running as a Libertarian, has also said that he would shut down data center proposals as governor. Another candidate who has joined the anti-data center fray is Abdul El-Sayed, currently running to be the Democratic nominee for the state's open Senate seat on a platform proposing strict regulation of such projects. Democrats should be taking more advantage of this moment to stand up to oligarchs and push back, he said bluntly. But unfortunately, if you're taking money from exactly the same oligarchs, you're probably not going to do that. Given that we live under a political system that runs on money, it may prove impossible to stop data centers' onward march, even if the grassroots rebellion continues to spread. But what if their financial defenses run short of cash, or the model on which the entire AI industry subsists founders? Haushalter and other data center resistors spoke of their worry that the AI bubble might pop and leave their community with the empty concrete shells of abandoned complexes, good for nothing except, as I heard one township board member quip, pickleball. As it stands, the data center economy appears remarkably unstable in light of the shocks caused by Trump's war on Iran. The price of the diesel needed to fuel data center generators has already climbed by 30%. Supply chain disruptions will only increase the exorbitant cost of building data centers, as well as the time it takes to complete them, during which the projects yield no revenue. Inevitable delays compound the interest on the debt burden for developers and for AI companies like Oracle. Most of these loans for data centers are interest only until construction is finished, Ed Zitron, a technology reporter and trenchant critic of the AI economy, told me. So all that principal isn't getting any lower. You're just handing money to the bank. It's not a great situation at all. In recent months, it seems that Wall Street has begun to catch on to these unappealing facts. Last December, even as the Saline Project enjoyed the approval of Michigan's utility regulators and the township board caved to related digital threats, Blue Owl, a private equity firm that has been a leading data center financier, announced that it was pulling out of the project to which it had previously committed $10 billion. The firm cited Oracle's rising debt levels and its extensive AI spending as justification. While Stargate found other financing, worries over debt loads persist. Perhaps we'll soon have a surfeit of pickleball courts. Andrew Cockburn is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. His latest book, Washington is Burning, was published in March. Next up is an essay, Strangers on a Train, The City That Bernie Getz Made, by Kevin Lozano. Discussed in this essay, the gods of New York, egotists, idealists, opportunists, and the birth of the modern city, 1986 to 1990, by Jonathan Mahler. Fear and Fury, the Reagan 80s, the Bernie Getz shootings, and the rebirth of white rage, by Heather Ann Thompson. Five Bullets, the story of Bernie Getz, New York's explosive 80s, and the subway vigilante trial that divided the nation, by Elliot Williams. At 55 West 14th Street, there sits a 20-story luxury rental building. Its pet-friendly 20-pound limit boasts a concierge and doorman and even offers on-site parking. The location is enviable, just two blocks west of Union Square. Great trains, great restaurants, and very walkable. A 782-square-foot one-bedroom rents for $5,900 a month. The building's most notorious resident has lived there since 1977, and his rent probably hasn't changed much from the $650 he paid back then. He runs an electronics repair business out of the apartment and, in his free time, looks after injured squirrels, sometimes giving them baths in the building's laundry room. His landlord unsuccessfully attempted to evict him on account of this hobby in 2015. Here are some other things the 78-year-old is known for. In 1989, he was immortalized in song by Lou Reed, Billy Joel, and the Beastie Boys. In 2001, he ran for mayor on a platform largely focused on vegetarianism, and in 2013, he was arrested for selling pot to an undercover cop. Bernard Bernie Goetz is the most notorious resident of 55 West 14th Street, not on account of his eccentricities, but for what he did 3 days before Christmas in 1984, when he boarded a downtown 2 train and shot 4 black teenagers, Troy Canty, Barry Allen, James Ronsour, and Daryl Cabey, who lived in Claremont Village in the South Bronx. That afternoon, the teenagers were headed downtown, intending to steal quarters from arcade machines. Eyewitnesses on the train described them as rowdy and annoying. After Goetz boarded at 14th Street, Canty approached him and, depending on whose account you believe, either asked him for or demanded $5. As the train made its way to the next stop at Chambers Street, Goetz fired 5 shots at the group. According to the police report, his first 3 bullets hit Canty, Allen, and Ramsour. He then turned and fired at KB, who was in the cabin's rear, the farthest from the fracas. Goetz thought he might have missed, so he walked over to the cowering 19-year-old. "You don't look so bad," he said to have told him. "Here's another." Then he fired a bullet that severed KB's spinal cord. After someone activated the train's emergency brake, Goetz sat down. When the conductor arrived at the scene, Goetz played the Good Samaritan, checking to make sure bystanders in the train car were unharmed. The conductor was slow to understand that Goetz was the assailant. After a brief interaction, Goetz managed to sneak off into the subway tunnel. He made his way back to street level, hailed a cab home, and escaped to Vermont in a rental car. The manhunt lasted 9 days. Little meaningful information was known about the 37-year-old Goetz. Police had to work mainly from a sketch, which Time magazine later likened to the face of the before figure in comic book ads for bodybuilding services. Goetz was an instant folkloric figure, the wimp turned subway vigilante. On New Year's Eve, Goetz turned himself in to the police in Concord, New Hampshire. When a New York assistant district attorney and a group of detectives showed up to interrogate him, Goetz insisted that robbery had nothing to do with it. The teenagers initially seemed like they were just kids kidding around, but something about their presence bothered him, he said. He particularly disliked Canty's smile when he asked for money. Goetz had shot them, he all but admitted, for what they symbolized about the city he had increasingly grown to hate. The squalor and grime, the poverty and desperation. Now, some 40 years later, 3 new books have revisited the shooting. Goetz is a recurring figure in the journalist Jonathan Mahler's book, The Gods of New York, which places his case alongside a handful of other transformative conflagrations in the late 80s, including the Black Monday stock market crash, the Central Park jogger case, the AIDS crisis, and the crack epidemic. Goetz is also the main subject of Fear and Fury by the historian Heather Ann Thompson and 5 Bullets by the CNN legal analyst Elliot Williams, both of which narrate the shooting and ensuing legal saga in great detail. Goetz, for all 3 authors, is an embodiment of the era's prevailing politics of fear. He was a human Rorschach test for New Yorkers, Mahler writes, revealing their deepest anxieties about the city. They present New York in those days as a natural incubator for reactionary violence, such that many observers at the time wondered if the shooting was not so much a random event as an inevitable one, a product of a city that was increasingly shaped by racial tensions, wealth inequality, and fears about crime. Though much has changed in the intervening decades, it's easy to recognize these aspects of Getz's era in our own. The renewed interest in his case raises an uncomfortable question. Is the city still ruled by its own violent ID? Brittany Getz moved to Manhattan from Florida in 1975, the year the city almost went bankrupt. The federal government and the city's creditors had demanded budget cuts, which in turn exacerbated the already squalid conditions around the city. Trash rotted in the streets, and fires dotted the skyline, especially in the South Bronx, where slumlords took advantage of the gutted fire department and the promise of easy insurance payouts. As the police department's rank shrank, crime festered, both above ground and below. Before the 70s, New York's social safety net was relatively robust. For decades, blue-collar jobs had outnumbered white-collar ones, and public services were plentiful and well-functioning, hospitals, daycares, parks, free education. But the recession of 1969-70 hit New York hard, draining the city of 500,000 jobs. By 1972, roughly 1 in 8 New Yorkers was receiving some form of public assistance, up threefold from a decade earlier. This placed an enormous amount of stress on the welfare system, which in turn became a vector of racialized hostility. New York couldn't pay its bills, many insisted, because it was too generous to black and brown people who had moved to the city in droves after the Second World War and who were said to be responsible for rising crime and disorder. The demonization of minorities was nothing new, of course, but New York in the 70s birthed a reactionary movement that was supported by politicians, public intellectuals, elites, and working people alike. In 1971, the Jewish residents of Forest Hills violently protested the development of a public housing project in their neighborhood with rocks and flaming torches. One of the protesters' most ardent defenders was the future mayor, Ed Koch, who reasoned that the protests were the product of a rational fear of increased crime and loss of property values. In 1977, he would center his mayoral campaign on two issues, bringing back the death penalty and shrinking the welfare state. He was successful only in the latter. That same year, when a citywide blackout led to looting sprees that many blamed on New York's black population, one could find the conservative pundit Midge Dechter in the pages of commentary comparing that same demographic to urban insect life. Getz was born in Queens to middle-class parents and raised on a farm upstate. His father was a German immigrant and modest business owner. After moving back to the city at 27, Getz became obsessed with local blight and racial animus came to dominate his worldview. He was soon complaining to his neighbors that spicks and niggers were ruining the area around their building. In other respects, he fit a very different profile. He was one of the college-educated new pioneers whom Koch envisioned populating the new city of New York and on whose behalf the city was to be cleaned up. Getz may have seemed to his neighbors like a loner and a crank, but his arrival to West 14th Street also made him a kind of vanguardist, part of an early wave of gentrification. Despite his misgivings about the city's disrepair, a transformation was underway, and the influx of wealth into his neighborhood would soon help remake much of downtown. In the wake of the shooting, many New Yorkers anointed him a hero for doling out street justice in the crime-riddled subway system. In January 1985, a daily news poll found that almost half of city residents thought his actions were justified. Other surveys found that Getz had a higher level of name recognition among New Yorkers than their own governor, Mario Cuomo, did. He attracted some famous fans, including the comedian Joan Rivers, who, Thompson tells us, wrote with an offer to pay his bail and signed her message with love and kisses. The National Rifle Association took out advertisements in New York's local papers, seeing Getz's growing celebrity as an opportunity to popularize self-defense legislation and loosen existing concealed carry restrictions. The highest elected officials in the city, Koch, State, Cuomo, and country, Reagan, denounced the shooting, which they all agreed was a sign of social and even civilizational breakdown. But they leavened these condemnations with appeals to law and order, something they felt New York sorely needed. Even reliably liberal commentators like Pete Hamill defended Getz, arguing that on that terrible afternoon, there were really five victims. That we know Getz's name, but hardly anything about his victims, is crucial to Thompson's history, which begins not with Getz, but with KB. He was the one who suffered the most. After the shooting, he fell into a coma from which he emerged with significant brain damage, in addition to being paralyzed. The hate mail started to trickle in, mostly addressed to KB's mother. "I hope your son is crippled for life to remind you that it was your responsibility to raise your child to be a decent human being and not an animal," read one letter. An initial grand jury, perhaps swayed by the defenses of Getz in the tabloid press, declined to indict him on any charges besides illegal possession of a weapon. But the DA's office was undeterred and provided additional evidence to convene a second grand jury, which indicted Getz on the additional charges of attempted murder, assault, and reckless endangerment. The presiding judge dismissed two of the new charges, but the New York Court of Appeals reversed the decision, and 2 years after the shooting, a criminal trial date was finally set for April 27, 1987. The trial was a circus. Getz's attorney sensed that the best way to defend him was to attack his victims, and they dragged the boys through the mud at every opportunity. To show that Getz had reason to fear for his life, they staged a dramatic reenactment of the shooting, enlisting four burly black members of the Guardian Angels to portray the teens. The tabloids were unwavering in their sense that the boys were getting exactly what they deserved, and Getz's fans called in death threats to their families day and night. Getz was ultimately acquitted of the most serious charges and served 8 months for illegal possession of a firearm. The mostly white jurors, many of whom had been victims of crimes themselves, evidently identified with Getz. When the trial ended, some even asked to have Getz sign their jury cards. The next day, Koch addressed a group of ministers at a church in Harlem. Many hoped he would endeavor to mend fences, but Koch instead defended the verdict. "There will always be those who say that racism played a role in the decision of the jury," he said. "I don't think this is an illustration of racism." The mayor exited through the back door to escape the jeers of his audience. Koch left office in 1989 after losing his campaign for an unprecedented fourth term to David Dinkins, who ran on the promise of easing racial tensions. Finally, in 1994, Rudy Giuliani rode a wave of resentment into Gracie Mansion, where he fulfilled the mandate of cleaning up New York through ruthless policing, bringing into reality the city Getz wanted. In 1996, Getz lost the civil trial that had been brought by KB's family. He was ordered to pay them $43 million in damages, a small measure of justice after more than a decade. But the KB's victory was short-lived. Getz declared bankruptcy and to this day lives in a state of alleged destitution to continue convincing his debt collectors that he does not have the means to pay any of his bills. He has not paid the KB's a cent. When Williams interviewed Getz in 2024, he found a man frozen in time. "You might eliminate some undesirables," he said, "but New York City's problems are a lot bigger now." When he moved to the West Village, Getz said, "It was a place you could reliably get the fuck away from the rest of society. Such a dream of dropping out is now impossible. They are making it unlivable, unaffordable for good people here, he said. Life might be more enjoyable and pleasant outside the city now. I think New York City is lost. Williams is quick to present Getz as a hateful paranoiac, because he is, but he largely stops short of offering a broader explanation for what happened. Thompson, by contrast, sees Getz and his fans as symptomatic of the Reagan Revolution's knee-jerk, deeply self-interested, and highly racialized narrative for how to fix the disorder unleashed by the economic downturns that began in the 60s. Getz's victims then were the intended targets of Reaganism's push for austerity, children of the welfare state, members of an unproductive populace that needed to be either silenced or liquidated. Thompson's characterization has its limitations. Austerity was by then a long-standing bipartisan project, carried out by Ford and Carter too. But like Williams and Mahler, she is responding to something obvious about Getz's story, which is that it is easy to transpose onto a larger narrative of what has happened to our city and our country in the decades since. It's Mahler who best sums this up, describing why we should still care about this era of New York's history. The great working-class city morphed into a city of entrenched poverty and extreme wealth, of celebrity, audacity, individualism, learned indifference, and resentment, foreshadowing the transformation of the broader nation. In many ways, the forces that roiled New York during the second half of the 1980s anticipated those that would roil America over the subsequent decades. The arrival of the global economy, the surge of immigrants, the nostalgia for a simpler time, the desire for order and authority, New York saw it all first. I'm going to have to stop here because of time limitations. Thanks so much for listening to these readings from the June 2026 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and looking forward to reading with you again soon.